Welcome everyone to What the Forest, and welcome to a new episode on The Searchers. And we're going to discuss all about the influence of The Searchers, the movie, on Star Wars. And with me to discuss this movie and hopefully many others is Amy Rickow. Welcome Hello. Back.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
And people would know you from 365 Days of Star Wars and 365 Days of Star Wars Women. So
yes, this is a big mouthful.
You're known throughout the internet for talking every single day of the year about Star Wars Women.
I know, hard to escape me unless you mute me.
But also something that, you know, people might know from listening to our previous episodes is that you do actually have a really big interest in film.
I do. I was a film studies major in college. And I worked in film preservation for many years. And so I helped restore and preserve films at UCLA Film and Television Archive and a couple different film labs, and spent a very brief but very lovely time at Skywalker Ranch at their film archives.
That's amazing.
It was very cool. I wish I would have just like hidden there and stayed.
Looking forward to the Lucas Museum where we can actually like go and immerse ourselves
oh my
in
gosh,
film.
Yes. Of course I am. Yes. No, I like, you know, I'm like, oh, I could move back to Los Angeles. That would work out.
I really enjoyed doing our last episode, which was on The Hidden Fortress, especially like how much Kurosawa's his shots, you can almost see them, you know, when you pair them and look side by side, you can see them kind of influencing Lucas, especially in how he chose to do specific shots for certain scenes to evoke action, etc. But The Searchers specifically seems to have been pulled into Lucas's psyche to evoke kind of different emotions, not just action, which right. is really cool. So did you want to give us a little bit of a background on The Searchers?
So sure. The Searchers came out in 1956, and it was directed by John Ford, who started directing shorts in 1917, and is really considered one of the best American film directors ever. He was a huge influence on a lot of directors from the 70s, George Lucas being one of them, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese. He had kind of a resurgence of his kind of fame in the 1970s. Like, people watched his films over and over and over again. But by the time The Searchers came out in 1956, he had already won 4 Academy Awards for Best Director, which is, I believe, a record, and a record I doubt will ever be broken. And he was very closely associated with John Wayne and made a lot of different Westerns, Stagecoach 1939 being an early one, and The Searchers in 1956 being a later one. And so it stars John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, Jeffrey Hunter as Martin Pauly, and a young Natalie Wood as Debbie Edwards. And so that is just a little bit. I don't know if you want me to go into plot or...
I can go into plot a little bit. So there is the Edwards family, who has a homestead in the middle of Texas. And it is the, you know, this place kind of in some ways idyllic because of the family unit. And in comes their uncle Ethan, who has come from the Civil War, which ended 3 years ago. The family has an older daughter, a younger daughter, and a young son, and an adopted, you know, young man named Martin, who was kind of a foundling, very much like Luke, actually. There's kind of a parallel there with the young adopted son. And he is a 8th Cherokee. And that's kind of important to the story because of we have Ethan Edwards, who's the uncle, coming home. And he very much has opinions and, you know, what's the right word for this, Marie Claire?
Is it that he's racist?
I was going to say bigoted attitudes. Yeah. bigoted attitudes towards like all of the indigenous population. This movie is fairly hard to watch if you are sensitive to this. So like, be warned if you go into this, you know, it doesn't necessarily treat the subject matter nicely. It was a 1950s movie, and it kind of it's very much of its time in some ways, and in some ways it is pushing and attempting to push outside of that. What ends up happening is there's a raid that happens. Martin and Ethan Edwards leave to go and attempt to help the local Texas Rangers with that raid and try and figure out what's happening. They realize it's a trap. And if, you know, they were there, then, you know, where else could they have gone? And they end up raiding the homestead, destroying the homestead, just much like the Lars homestead in A New Hope. But this time they actually capture the young girl and take her away. And it becomes a journey of trials in an attempt to have Martin, the young adopted kid, and Ethan Edwards, the obsessed uncle, in an attempt to bring Debbie home. The tricky part of this is John Wayne, who normally would have played, you know, kind of the white knight hero in previous films, in this one, kind of older now in his roles and what he was playing, ends up playing a very dark anti-hero who has, you know, first his mission is to save her, but once he discovers that time has passed, 5 years passes throughout the course of the movie, so that's a little odd to get used to. He ends up making the decision that kind of through his logic that because she was taken and married off inside of the tribe, that she was now tainted. And so it wavers between his desire to want to kind of purge that taint and kill her and Martin wanting to save her. And that's where the conflict really lies in the movie. And it's really well done. And I think that that's really what drew kind of an entire generation of directors that have affected cinema even to today, that this conflict between this young kid who wants to save her and this old man who wavers between wanting to save her and wanting to kill her and take revenge for what happened is really the driving force of the movie. In the end, the decision is made to bring her home and he walks off into the sunset, which is interesting. It is very Western, like the shots, the feeling. He has this thing he says that is almost classic. It was incorporated into maybe the 1950s, 1960s vocabulary because of Buddy Holly. It, you know, that'll be the day. He says that all throughout the movie. So John Wayne's character, Ethan Edwards, and then Buddy Holly and his band, the Crickets, went to go see it and they made a song about it. That'll be the day. So it's like the movie itself influenced way beyond cinema. It influenced kind of culture of the time. So it was a very important movie. But it, like, you know, we were talking about before this, it didn't win a lot of awards or anything.
Yeah, even though he'd won Best Director 4 times, like The Searchers was not even nominated for any awards and wasn't a film that I don't think was really celebrated at the time, but was more rediscovered kind of in the 70s. And, you know, it's an interesting film because, I mean, you know, its portrayal of Native Americans is they are savages. And if any white woman is around them, they become less than human. And so like, it's like a favor to kill them because like, they're gone. Like, they're no longer like, you know, who they are, they're gone. So that is really obviously like not something that is like, you know, good to see. Mm-hmm. It also like, I think that the character of Martin is someone who is the conscience of the film.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, when I think about The Searchers, I hadn't seen it for a very long time before we decided to do this podcast. But when I thought about it, I was like, what I remember about it is it's about obsession. Like it's about a very, very obsessive man who is, you know, John Wayne's character is not likable. For, you know, like he demands your attention. He's like he's like a very, very memorable character. It is a really great performance by John Wayne, who himself is problematic. If you what he said in a lot of his interviews, which is extremely offensive, like a man of his time, I suppose you could say, or just a man who didn't think that, you know, people who weren't white were as good as him. Like, you know, it's hard to know. But I mean, certainly what he said horrible things in interviews. So, you know, I'm going to take him at his word that he believes that stuff. Oh, but like his acting is amazing in this film. Mm-hmm. He's hard to take your eyes off of, but like he is driven by pure obsession. And I think that at first he thinks he is trying to do the good thing where like, you know, like, oh no, I'm the hero. Like I'm going to go do this. Like I'm going to, you know, this is what I do. Like as I go mm-hmm. and I save people. But by the end of it, I don't even like, he's just trying to like finish the job, but like mm-hmm. the way in his way, finishing the job is murdering a young innocent girl.
Yeah.
Like he just becomes so obsessive about this and finding Scar, who is the Native American chieftain who did the raid, that mm-hmm. he just loses all sense. I'm not even sure if he had a really strong sense of right or wrong. I mean, cause he literally just like insults, you know, Martin right away for not yeah. being 100% white at the very beginning. And so like, he's a very flawed person, I suppose you could say, but like he loses complete sense of right and wrong by the end of it. And then kind of like, at the very, very end of it, he's like, oh no, I'm not going to kill you. Like I'm going to hug you, you know, which yeah. is a little, you know, then you're like, oh, okay. Like, you know.
Yeah. Like, I think he was just, well, I think it was like, he was very much on the edge of wanting to kill her in the end. And he just like almost on autopilot, like decides to complete his original mission, which is, it was fascinating to watch. I really, really appreciated kind of that internal conflict. And I think that what's really, really important to call out is like how influential this movie is. So it is like the benchmark that many directors who we consider to be the best of the best, you know, use to basically say, this is obsession, this is revenge, this is, and they view this movie as kind of that lens. And then it not seeps, it directly comes into their work. Like Taxi Driver is almost like a modern retelling of The Searchers.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really like if you can look at different films and how they were, you know, influenced in different ways, like the mm-hmm. storytelling in it. Like I was watching a documentary and they were just talking about how, you know, they don't really show the violence, but they show the effect of the violence. And I think that a lot of times you're used to, you know, the violence having completely happening completely off screen or seeing the violence. But like, you know, people are getting scalped in this movie, but you never see it. You see the yeah. after effects, you know, people have died. Sometimes you do see the bodies and there's like you see, like you don't see the people being killed, but then you see their bodies. Sometimes you don't even see that. Like you just see, like there's a scene where there's like, you see a bloody dress.
Yeah.
And they're like, and like, but then you don't, you know, see it. But like, that's almost more horrific just to see, to not see it. Cause like, then your mind kind of wanders. And then also the focus is just more not on like, oh, I'm going to like shock the audience by showing this very like violent thing, but I'm going to show the effect it has on the characters
yeah.
and how that drives them and how that, you know, drives through the story.
And you feel the emotions, especially like Martin wanting to see and Ethan preventing him from seeing. You see that and that tension between the two of them, like in some ways, like Ethan and Martin are of course the center of the movie, but they're almost like polar opposites in a way that bring kind of this weird balance to the movie, because like Martin himself is young and in love and, you know, still has his whole life ahead of him and has compassion for people and drive, but doesn't necessarily want to kill everybody that he comes across. Like he has compassion for many people.
And he has compassion for the Native Americans.
Yeah.
Even when, you know, John Wayne is like, look, buddy, I like wasn't going to tell you this, but like one of the scalps like that, you know, we saw in Scar's teepee,
that was
like,
totally,
that's from your mom. And he's yeah. like, that doesn't change. He's immediately like, that doesn't change the fact that like, I don't want you to kill that girl. Like, yeah. you know,
yeah.
He sees the humanity of everyone. And like when he comes, like there's a scene where you see you see a Native American village and how the U.S. Cavalry has massacred them. Like there's this, you know, very moving scene with Martin, like holding, you know, like look like by a woman, like a Native American woman who had died. And he's like, why did they do this? You know, like, and at a time when a lot of people wouldn't even question why, you know, the cavalry wouldn't have killed everyone. Like, of course they killed, you know, like, you're like, oh, of course they killed everyone. But he's really, you know, he's questioning the people around him. He clearly looks up to Ethan, I think. And Ethan wants nothing to do with them at the beginning because he's like, you know, don't call me uncle. Don't call me this, you know, like, you know.
Well, and he's very much our POV too, right? Like Martin is our point of view. He is experiencing this, and he goes through kind of a very odd hero's journey in it. In that, like, he comes back and actually, like, you know, tries to reinitialize his life, but he's still stuck in the darkness that he needs to go and, you know, go on his journey. And you can map it to a hero's journey. It's neat if you look at it from Martin's perspective, because at the point that he is, you know, kind of you know, is in the underworld, he becomes the master of life and death when he kills Scar, because he saves Debbie and kills Scar. It's just, it's really, really cool to actually see that. But what's most important is that we as the audience empathize with him.
Absolutely.
And his journey. Yeah. And are like the Ethan, you're going too far, and recognizing that Ethan isn't a heroic figure. And Martin is learning through him on what not to do, which is really interesting.
I think, like, he sees that Ethan, who, you know, I think has been talked up as, you know, because Ethan returns and everyone's like, oh my gosh, Ethan's back, you know, our hero, like war hero and everything like that. And I think that then he, you know, realizes that, you know, just because someone is presented to you as a, you know, as a hero and they can do no wrong and they're your elder and everything like that doesn't mean that you need to follow in their path.
Well, and like he follows him and he has this really great conversation with his love interest, Lori, where he says, if I'm not there, I'm scared about what will happen. Like, because he really realizes that there is a darkness in Ethan and that without him there, that darkness will take over.
Yeah.
And he's keeping him. He's like the preventative measure that will keep Debbie alive if all else fails, in his mind, I think.
Right.
Yeah. It's just really fascinating. And I do have this, like, really kind of cool quote, which is Andrew Saris in 1978. So this is, again, like a long time, 22 years after The Searchers came out, said, a new generation of directors has been inspired by John Wayne's vengeful quest for a lost niece in Comanche country. And this was from the 25 most memorable cult films of the time. So 22 years after, it is still a cult film in the 1970s. So 1978, and this is, you know, again, just after Star Wars had come out, but already it had influenced, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg and Lucas significantly. In fact, they were all between the ages of 11 and 14 when they originally saw it in the theaters. And it really, really seems to affect them. You can go in and watch, like, Scorsese's interviews talking about The Searchers and how, like, his experience as a 13-year-old kid, and he came in and watched the last half of it and then the whole movie, like, his tale is really interesting to hear.
It is. And I think that, you know, I think that what's, you know, what's really important to understand about The Searchers too, and what's worth, even if, like, you know, the subject matter isn't interesting to you, is it is one of the most gorgeous movies I've ever seen. Like, it is this huge vista, monument valley, like, gorgeousness. And when we were talking earlier about, like, similarities between, you know, this movie and Star Wars, like, I really feel like all of these wide shots of the vista focusing on the location, having the location, whether it being Tatooine or Hoth or, you know, Jakku, like, having the location be a character and, like, having it be integral to what's going on is just, like, that's a huge part of Star Wars to me. And, like, the location is absolutely, like, and, you know, a character in The Searchers. And if you pause any part of the Searchers, like, it's gorgeous. And a lot of Star Wars is the same way too. And the Searchers was in VistaVision, which is like a high resolution, like super widescreen.
It's like IMAX of the time.
It is gorgeous, like, you know, to see, like, and I haven't seen it, like, because it's not even like around, but, like, you know, it had a huge influence on, like, the kids that saw it at the time, because it just was like this otherworldly kind of, you know,
like, you were brought experience into the movie because it was just gorgeous. And it never explains, like, one of the things that, like, I appreciate about Star Wars, and I saw a lot in the Searchers, is that it allows the cinematography to set up where they are. So you breathe for a moment wherever they're going. They, like, you ride in, or you see this panorama of where they are in Monument Valley, which is supposed to be Texas, which it's not, where they film it.
Right.
Like, so... And they go all over the place. They go to New Mexico, and they go, you know, they're way up north because it's snowy. And, you know, there's all of these different things because they're kind of following this Comanche tribe. They're on the trail this whole time. And it's very much like a road of trials. It's very, very thematically appropriate that it feels like it takes a really long time because they're kind of always on this obsessive search. But wherever they go, they always establish kind of these wide shots, which Star Wars does very well. It breathes for a moment in the movie, and then they say, here's what's happening in this moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, and just the structure and the way that they lay out the story, it really, again, like, even if you're not a Western fan, like, I think it's really interesting. And I mean, it is an interesting influence of Star Wars where, I don't know if you want to get into this right now, but, like, there are certain sequences, like, from A New Hope or, like, in Attack of the Clones that you're like that are, like, widely called out because you're like, oh, that was absolutely influenced by the Searchers.
Yeah, like, we can talk about those shots right now because this, you know, we're kind of talking about the cinematography, but there's specifically the ones that are always called out is the Burning Homestead. And it's almost like Martin coming over the ridge, seeing the Burning Homestead, is almost like a direct parallel from a cinematography perspective, shot for shot. You can almost see it be lined. You can watch videos where they, like, line them up, and it's like, oh, Lucas, that's what you were thinking. But he was trying to evoke, like, I think that feeling of what happened. Of course, you know, in The Searchers, Ethan Edwards is also there. As well as their other friend who's there. Mose is there.
Yeah.
So, like, there's three people there, but, you know, Martin coming over the hill and seeing the homestead burning, Luke coming home, seeing the homestead burning, looks very, very similar. And, like, kind of almost the angles and everything like that. The thing that you pointed out before, we don't actually see any of the bodies, whereas in Star Wars A New Hope, we actually do see, you know, Aunt Beru and Uncle Lars. Another tiny thing. There's a Lars homestead as well in The Searchers. So,
when I was watching it again too, I thought it was kind of, and this is probably reaching too far, but I thought it was interesting where, like, they show, like, in obviously in A New Hope, you don't see Beru and Owen, like, you don't see anything where they know that they're in trouble, that, like, someone is coming to, like, you know, to invade, you know, their home. But in The Searchers, you do. Like, the family inside the home knows that the Native Americans are coming. They know that they're in trouble, and they try to send Debbie away. And I was like, I meant to look at Rogue One, because I was like, I think that they have the same braids, like the same hairstyle. But it reminded me of them sending Jin away, where, like, they, like,
because they
had a plan for Debbie. It was not a good plan, because she immediately got caught. It was like, go hide in the cemetery, like, but, like, there was no place to hide, and Scar was right there. But, like, they, you know, like, they immediately, like, took her and were like, you know what to do. Like, they knew that someone was coming. And so that reminded me a little bit of Rogue One, even though, again, like, it had very different means, but, like, she had, like, braids and it was, like, curled up, and I was like, is that what little Jin looked
like? Yeah.
Yeah, like, in A New Hope, you have the bones of Luke's family, and in The Searchers, you have a bloody dress, which is also quite horrific to see, which is really almost like just seeing a bloody dress is almost more scary than seeing a body, because it's like, it just kind of is really jarring. And then Martin tries to go into the house, but John Wayne's character is like, no, 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 you can't see it. And I know that like several directors, when they talk about this film, say how like, if John Wayne, who like was such a heroic, like just otherworldly, huge movie star kind of tough guy, like if John Wayne doesn't want to go back to see what, you know, like is in there, like then I don't want to either. And how that really, that like, you know, like unwillingness to show you what's going on, but then just showing you the effect of it was just kind of, you know, it was scary.
It was very effective. Yeah. There's also a lot of, you know, the scruffy but charismatic rebel kind of self-serving attitude of John Wayne in this movie that feels very Han-like and kind of ends up playing out a little bit, you know, with the short temper and the quick, you know, one-liner snap back and handsome, because like John Wayne was considered to be very handsome even at that age, you know, so there's a lot of things from a similarity perspective with John Wayne and then the young kid that's kind of like with him.
Yeah, because John Wayne's character is like, don't call me a hero. Don't call me a this. Like, I did it. You know, anyone would have done it. You know, like, just very kind of like,
yeah.
He doesn't want to be praised. He for sure doesn't want to be questioned. Like, you know, in any way, like, he does not care whatsoever what anyone else in that movie thinks about him. And I don't think that Han is the same. Like, I mean, I just like, maybe he cares what Leia says, but like, you know, like, there is no, you know, there is no person that I think Ethan, you know, Martin gets through to him. I think.
Yeah.
But like, there's no acknowledgement of that.
No. No. I also think, generally speaking, when we look at Tatooine, so that's like, you know, when we're there for A New Hope, when we're there for
Attack of the Clones.
Attack of the Clones. Even like the two kind of riding through the desert. You know, in The Mandalorian, like the feeling of Tatooine is very influenced by The Searchers. Wide shots, seeing, you know, not a lot of movement with the camera, you know, seeing C-3PO walk through the desert, and that like very, that figure of being lonesome, like you can almost see a shot in The Searchers that's exactly like that, with like one single horseman, I think, is walking through the riding through the desert. Just the feeling of loneliness is very pervasive through The Searchers, but also it's something that's quite common when we see Tatooine, except for in the larger cities.
Yeah, I mean, it's so isolated. The like, I mean, in A New Hope, and it, especially like everything in The Searchers is so isolated. And one of my favorite shots is when John Wayne and then the character Martin are like, they've seen Debbie and now they're kind of away from like that. And they're like having a conversation and they're right by this big sand dune. And there are so many great sand dune shots in Star Wars. And then Debbie like pops up from out of nowhere and starts running down. And they play this very like joyful music where it's like, oh, she got away. She's escaping. Like they're all going to be reunited. But then it's like the shock that she's like, go away. Like, this is my home, you know, go away. But like all of like using of the sand dunes and like people like being positioned in different places and like running up and down and like being hidden by it. Like all, I think what you were saying just really, I mean, it does seem like Tatooine and it does seem like a lot of, you know, The Mandalorian. And I think that, you know, there, you can make a direct, many people have done this before. This is not a new idea, but like that, you know, the Tusken Raiders, you know, seem like to be an obvious parallel between Native Americans. Like they were there first. They feel like, you know, their land, I mean, rightfully so, like is their land is being encroached upon. And the people who are there now don't see them as human and see them as savages, see them as unworthy even to communicate with in a lot of cases. And, you know, if anyone like Anakin, you know, in Attack of the Clones, obviously like never gives up on Shmi, his mom. Like he wants to, like, he wants to, you know, bring her back. Like there was no way that, like, you know,
and that scene
he was going to hurt her. Like, and so like, that's a very kind of different thing. Like the fact that, like, you know, his obsession to get her back and like how he goes from like just wanting to save her to then he can't save her because he can't save her. And so then he just like goes on a murder spree. Like, you know, like that obsession, I think, is like a direct, you know, can be a direct parallel because, you know, I mean, John Wayne's character is just so, so obsessive that like he would completely wipe out that, you know, like he would have wiped out Debbie and everyone there at the end if that's what it took to kind of like close out, you know, that his story. Yeah. But Anakin obviously like was not ever going to hurt you know, he was never going to hurt his mother.
But what's interesting is that that's still within Anakin's character in the end, like especially with Padme and his obsession as he becomes Darth Vader. Like we now right. know he like literally never gives up on Padme.
No, I mean like, and he doesn't.
I don't mean
like,
to laugh.
Like
I just
blinded by his obsession.
Yeah,
like he just really, really like how, even when he's directly confronted by Padme, in you know Mustafar, like she's just like, "Hello, like we can run away. We could be together." You, yeah. you know, like he really is just so completely blinded
it's
by his
very
quest.
Ethan. Very
yeah. No, I mean it is. Yeah. Like, I mean it's just like you know obsession that like blinds you.
Mm-hmm.
Blends like, you to what's going on.
And like those revenge aspects too. It's like revenge on the people that like, who are you revenging anymore? Like you've lost sight of everything because of all of the, you know, almost circling you've done around this thing that you've been obsessed with for so long. Really, really interesting. And I think that that's important to take away from you if you watch this movie or if you're kind of just listening to this, is that this has driven an entire generation of, you know, filmmakers who see obsession and revenge and this like dark character, you know, and we're very influenced by Ethan Allen or Ethan Edwards,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's just really, really important to see that. So the scene where in Attack of the Clones where Anakin is, you know, looking for Padme is like the movie The Searchers in like 10 minutes. Like, so like he heads off to go and find her. He goes and has his little journey where he goes and speaks with Jawas. He's riding through the desert. He does a couple of things. He figures out where they are. And we actually get shots of him on the cliff that parallel from a cinematography perspective very, very closely to seeing Ethan Edwards on the Ethan on the cliff looking over the Comanche village. And it's startling when you see them back to back. So I'll link to a few videos where it actually compares these shots because
fun to watch. I think it's also important if you haven't seen The Searchers to understand that the Native Americans who take Natalie Wood's character do not hurt her.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously you can argue that you shouldn't abduct someone and take them away from their home, but they, you know, like they do treat her well when she is living with them.
Yeah.
And the worst part of this movie is the treatment of the Native Americans. But the thing that I wish I could change other than that from this movie is it would have been great to have had more of Natalie Wood's character in there because it really goes back and forth on a yo-yo where like they see her, they find her, they reconnect, and she's like, no, you got to go. Like, these are my people. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to go. And as soon as she says, these are my people, John Wayne, Ethan wants to kill her. Like, yeah. I mean, like right there, he they cut to him. You see his face. It's very similar to like the close up of his face when like there's another scene earlier on where they show white women who have been taken, who were abducted, had spent time with Native Americans and then have been like rescued mm-hmm. by the white man. And they are portrayed as babbling idiots who are like not even human anymore. Like they're like,
it's like women. Very nicely.
It does not. No, I mean, it's like literally like these women are like playing with like little dolls and like not even speaking any language. Like they're just babbling idiots because they have been, you know, ruined. And like, you know, like, and Ethan says, you know, like they're not white anymore. Like they're gone.
Yeah.
And like they show this like close up of his face. And then that mirrors when Natalie Wood's character says,
"These are my people." Yeah. You should
and
go.
Ethan, and Martin immediately has to like stand, like put his body in front of her and Ethan.
Yeah,
because Ethan protect her, but
gonna
then
hurt her. Yeah,
and then it's like, well, why are you even? If she doesn't want to come back, like, are you like? what do you do? I mean, like, and I actually think that's complicated because like, if someone has been taken, like you want it to be their choice, but like, you know, like ideally, like you kind of bring her home and then be like, what do you want to do? You know, like, do you want to go? Do you want to stay? Like, what do you want to do? There's no conversation with her. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, when they see her again, then she's like, oh no, you're here. Yay. Let's go home. Which is a complete reversal.
So that scene like is very odd for me because she sees Martin and I think she's happy to see Martin. I don't know that she's necessarily happy that Martin kills, you know, Scar, her husband.
Well, she screams when she sees Scar, but like, I don't know if Scar has like a weapon, which I mean, would make sense. Because they don't show Scar. That's what's like, yeah. That's one of those great you don't even see Scar's face, but you know that when Martin is shooting, you know that it must be Scar.
And he has a scar. That is why he's named Scar, by the way. And it's a very like Anakin, or it's a very Kylo Ren scar. Like it's like,
well,
a cross.
I think that the actor who plays Scar is also German, which is, you know, questionable.
Yeah. He has very blue eyes, by the way. So it's very startling. So like he actually has a scar and it's very like Kylo Ren in a way, like because it's across his forehead and down across his eye and across his cheek. In that moment, like I think she just realizes she has no place to go, you know, because like he kills Scar and then she's like, well, where am I supposed to go now? So she tries to like stay with Martin, I think, or she escapes and then she escapes because she's like, where am I going to go? And then...
they somehow get John separated because then she's like running away from Ethan. Yeah.
And then she's running away from Ethan because Ethan is now like, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
Which is just,
that scene is like he's trying to catch a cow that has gotten away from the herd. Like he's on his horse chasing after her. Like he's going to like lasso her and like, you know, like tie her down. And she, you know, and right into the last minute, like it really seems like it might go.
Well,
wrong.
Like and when he picks her up, so he like at the end, he captures her. There's like this canyon type cave and he like picks her up and it's like, he almost like shakes her and then he like makes this split second decision to like bridle carry her.
Well, and like he like lifts her up so high, like you wouldn't lift up a woman that high.
Yeah, like, it was like
you lift up
like,
a little girl. It's like he saw that he like saw the little girl in her that he knew before, you know, she was abducted. Like it's so high. And then like it is basically, it is like, I'm just going to carry, you know, it's like he's like pretending that she's back to this like little girl.
He
decided to kind of block out, you know, the last couple of years, which are to him still, I'm sure,
very fresh.
Illegal. Like you can't, you know, like, you know, recover from it.
Well, and like he kind of shakes her. And I think that was like the, no, this is still the little girl moment. And it's all just played out without words, which is beautiful. Well, a little bit of Martin screaming, Ethan, in the background.
Martin the entire time is like running behind the horse being like, don't kill her, don't kill her.
Shirtless.
Yeah, I know he is shirtless.
I think he was trying to sneak into the village.
He did sneak into the village shirtless. Yeah, actually, yeah. I watched that scene later and I was like, why is his shirt off? He's got a shirt, he's carrying it.
And so like I think this is just really interesting because captivity narratives, which we have actually quite a bit of account for from white women who were captured, primarily for ransom, because you know, especially colonialists and settlers were willing to pay the, you know, indigenous population that captured their women to get their women back and be like, don't taint them, but, you know, bring them back. So they were, it was like almost a commodity to capture these women. And this is the rabbit hole I went down to on the last 2 days, which was, you know, doing research into, okay, what happened and how did this narrative come to this place? And what was being said by the searchers? And then what is being said by George Lucas by using these things, especially, you know, the use of the sand people, the Tusken Raiders, the similarities between that, but then also not having the raids that ended up happening in New Hope be done by the Tusken Raiders necessarily, but actually by the Empire, the colonialists. Colonialists destroy the homestead, which would be, you know, like the army, basically. destroying the homestead in The Searchers, which is a very big change. And so, you know, many people agree that this story is based on the actual kidnapping of 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, who was captured by Comanche warriors and, you know, in Texas, in Fort Parker. And 24 years later, she was quote unquote rescued by the Texas Rangers and her uncle. And he was obsessed and spent his life and fortune trying to bring her back. In the end, they killed her husband, who was now part of the tribe, and she had had two sons and a daughter. And she ended up kind of being a victim of both sides of this conflict in the end. And like her son ended up becoming a very important chief, very famous chief. Now there's actually like there's a very good book that came out all about this that actually has, you know, accounts of how this story sort of transformed into myth and then was made into a book itself that then The Searchers was based on.
Wait, I think that the idea of like saving a young girl from someone who's stolen her is such like a, yeah, well, that's a good story. Like, what could go wrong there? Like, I mean, of course you're going to want to like return that girl, you know, like it seems like a good guy, bad guy thing, but then it's just, you know, it can get complicated.
Classic in our psyche, like, because it's Odysseus, right? Trying to go to Troy to rescue Helen of Troy. Well,
I mean, none of the women in The Searchers have any say in anything.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Debbie is like, she's there, she's hiding, she gets captured. She says she wants to stay. They keep trying to get her. And then like, you know, like she thinks she's going to die. And then, you know, like she does, you know, get returned, and she does in the end seem happy, you know, she's getting returned. But there's a woman who like wants to get married and like is just constantly waiting. And then she's going to get married up to somebody else. And then, you know, like, but like her whole storyline is like, who is she going to marry? And that the fact that she's waiting and has no control about if the men in her life are going to leave for potentially years, you know, and mm-hmm. what, you know, can she do? And like, you're basically like, you're, you know, you're a girl, you're a wife or your mom. And like, there's nothing, you know, that women are doing that is changing the story. They're just kind of like features of the story.
Well, and like one of the important things that many people have pointed out, both Glenn Frankel, who wrote The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, which covers kind of the story, the real story, the mythology around it, and then how it kind of came to be The Searchers. I think it's just a really important book to understand because it's like how this conversation almost transformed because of the fear of, you know, what could happen to our women is almost like pervasive in the culture, and how that kind of transformed to these, we've got to get her back. And I'm not saying that this story is not like new, but in many ways, it's also the story of Leia, right? She's the captive in, you know, we've got to go and rescue her, you know? She's the captive in,
right,
in A New Hope. But also this narrative plays out probably because of the parallels that A New Hope has with TFA, or TFA has with A New Hope. It plays out in TFA, this narrative of a bad guy has captured, you know, the young girl, and we got to get her back. And we end up having, you know, our older mentor and our young kid, Han and Finn. And Finn is obsessed with getting her back and keeping her alive. And Han is like, okay, I got to do what's right. But then once he discovers who's taken her, his obsession changes to Kylo Ren, right? So it's just really interesting that this narrative still has an undercurrent in our culture, like the damsel in distress narrative.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's been around for a long time. It'll probably be around, you know, you know, for a long time, at least with, you know, with, it was nice that Rey, like, and Leia to some extent, you know, like Leia certainly played a part in saving herself. She didn't get herself out of the actual cell for the detention block, but she got them out of the block. And Rey saved herself. And then it was like, hey, you know, like,
yeah,
finds him in the hallway, like, you know.
Yeah, it's like, hey, what's going on? So it's certainly changing and different. What ends up happening is, like, we don't get the full story in the legend, right? We get the, you know, oh, the good guys were saving the day. We don't get the full story in the, you know, in the book that the Searchers is based on. But the Searchers itself plays a little bit more with the grays associated with both sides. You know, what Absolutely. We've already talked about, right? And so even though maybe it wasn't executed as well as it could be done, this is a big step for Ford to actually, and this is what you'll hear when you talk about, when these directors talk about the Searchers, is that this was so different, you know, to kind of say that what the hero of my childhood is doing might not be 100% good, and his motivations might not be perfect. And right. there's I mean, a lot
just,
of gray.
Just showing these deeply, deeply, you know, flawed men. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it is really like, yeah, it's a very, I was very pleased that it, I really had it in my mind that, like, the last time I'd seen The Searchers, that I was so, so impressed with it. And I was a little like, okay, I hope when I see it again, it's not gonna, you know, mm-hmm. disappoint me. But it really is just like the way that it's, you know, put together. The cinematography is amazing. Mm-hmm. The way that, you know, the camera just kind of like sometimes sits there and like everything kind of like plays out. Like, he doesn't like do crazy things with the camera, like crazy angles and swooping dollies and stuff like that. He really just kind of, you know, makes it more like where you feel like you're there.
Yeah, I just, like, I asked myself as this, like, person that I was, like, going down the rabbit hole. I'm like, the cinematography obviously is something that, like, drew these directors who have this eye for this and were very impassioned by the, you know, the art of cinematography and, you know, trying to get things pictured on film and convey certain things with visuals, especially. The music is... in some ways kind of whimsical. There's a point where Lori's being courted by another guy and he plays Skip to Malou, and then the music itself as they, you know, go to a cut to go to the next scene, like a transition, you hear Skip to Malou in the music.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, in some points it's whimsical and yet sometimes it's scary.
Well, it's a dark story. And I think yeah. that having music that like does that, or like, you know, it does a pretty good job of having comedic moments. There's some like, you know, like smaller characters that kind of bring a little bit of element of, you know, humor to be.
Yeah. Because
it's a dark story.
It's a very dark story. And then there's like the fight at the wedding.
That, I know. That's all just very
yeah, it's like very comedic in some ways. Like it almost feels like it goes back and forth. And I was like, okay, so what is it about this movie that really is influencing like all of our cinema, like so much of our cinema going forward? What is it about it? And I think it's just, you know, it was so different than the movies and almost the cultural coding that had happened in the cinema from these directors, like the directors that they had been seeing before this, that it was almost like it kind of snapped them out of, hey, you know what? Actually, something could be different. And this character is so significantly different than anything I've ever seen John Wayne do. And I think it just kind of really, and the cinematography is beautiful and extremely breathtaking. I think that was it. And I think that George's choices, especially in A New Hope, and kind of the changes from the character motivation to like, the bad guys are the colonials, the army, the people that are supposed to protect the homesteaders. the bad guy ends up being the hero, like the hero ends up being the bad guy, you know, even more so than what happened to with Ethan Edwards Ethan Edwards in, you know, the raid on the village. Anakin ends up, our, you know, pure boy Anakin ends up doing this really horrific and going further. It's like George decided to kind of take these concepts and say, you know what, maybe I can question them. And almost like if we were to view Tatooine in The Mandalorian as like trying to correct, you know, a perception of what indigenous people could be like. It's like, you know, if Dave Filoni, who directed and wrote that episode, was trying to say like, you know, hey, you know, this is what we took from The Searchers before. There was that you know, little tete-a-tete where they sold some stuff and they got some information. Maybe we could actually make it like a valuable exchange and do it differently. Cause it's like each of these exchanges is almost different and it means something different to the characters. And it says something different than what happens in The Searchers. And it almost like says something more powerful. George managed to take it and make it different and more powerful. It's really interesting.
You, I mean, cause like The Mandalorian is like, you know, it's, you know, like he, you know, he comes in, he's obviously like the main character of The Mandalorian, but like, you know, you don't know very much about him. Like you hear kind of conflicting information about him. Like, is he a good person? Is he a bad person? And I think that that's one of the things that is enjoyable about that is not knowing exactly how to feel about him, especially near the beginning until he becomes, you know, Baby Yoda's dad. And then you're like, oh no, he's fine. But, you know, I think that for The Searchers, like I think for most movies, you feel the way you're supposed to, you know how you're supposed to feel about every single scene of a movie as you go along. You just kind of follow it along. Most people have the same feelings about the characters, like this person's good, this person's bad, or like these people, I want them to get together, they're in love, or like there's like, you know, they're going to do this heist and they're doing this. And in The Searchers, you're just really conflicted a lot of times about how to feel about what's going on. And
it really, challenges
feel
the
like
audience.
I'm coded to feel like this, especially since it's John Wayne, especially since it's John Ford. And, you know, a lot of people had seen so many of their other films. And you're just like, wow, like, you know, I don't know what to feel about this. Like, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about this. Like it's the entire thing is played out as like a heroic, happily ever at ending with like he walks out the door. Who knows where he's going? He doesn't even have a horse, I don't think. He's just literally walking out. It's like he's walking out into Tatooine without like any kind of form of transportation. Yeah. And like then they close the door and you're inside, and then it's kind of like, you know, like a book closing. It's like very like almost a fairy tale kind of ending.
Well, because like the movie starts with the door opening and you see
that's vista. That is one of the most gorgeous shots too. Like, I mean, she opens the door and you see outside, and I was like, oh my God, this is why I think this movie is beautiful. Like it is so beautiful.
Yeah. And then it closes again. And after kind of like, there's these happy reunions. I would say Debbie is less happy, but she almost doesn't
she's
really
in shock.
Yeah. Like she literally doesn't even know what's happening. She's like, I thought I was going to die and now I'm here. After riding for like 40 miles, I think was the distance they originally stated when they left the first time. So it's probably that much, but 40 miles is like not a small amount of distance on horseback. Wait,
and everyone else is shocked too. Cause I think that like, it's not, you know, if women disappeared, like, I don't think that they normally came back.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it really like, I mean, the scene that's extremely disturbing earlier on when they show like a couple girls who are like maybe like teenagers. And then they show like, you know, a couple women who are just, you know, again, just like completely like, they're like infants, you know, like they've completely lost their ability to communicate as, you know, a regular kind of person. I think that they're like in a jail kind of an area where like they've been, like, the sheriff found them and they're kind of like hanging out in the sheriff's office or something like that. But like, you really just wonder like what, you know, what happened to them? Like, cause it didn't seem like they were going to go home.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you read Debbie's face, you know, she's lost twice. And I think that comes through. The only one who seems semi-okay to come home is Martin. Because he comes home and Lori's there waiting for him.
Yeah. And that is the happy part of the ending. Yeah. Is that they are can now be together.
Yeah. Like, you're supposed to identify with Martin this whole movie and see, like, okay, you know, he's finally done what he needed to do and he can exist and grow up and get out of his kind of adolescent journey life and become a man. Like, that was his threshold that he needed to go through.
Oh, and thank goodness that character is there. Otherwise, it would have been like three times as dark.
Yeah. I think that, like, people often refer to, like, the darkest part of the movie being that, you know, they find a dead, buried Comanche man, and he, Ethan, they uncover him, and Ethan decides to shoot his eyes out because then he has to wander and he can't, like, go on to kind of his afterlife. It's very dark because it's like, you know, it's described as like saying, well, Ethan cares so much about revenge that he's willing to take it past death.
Yeah. And you realize that, like, I think if you were even kind of identifying with them up until that point, that's like, oh, like, you know, whoa, like, what is going on? Like, that was extreme. Like,
yeah.
And hopefully at that point you start not identifying with them so much.
Well, and I have this really good quote from, again, Glenn Frankel, who wrote, you know, the book all about kind of the myth behind it. But he said, Ford understands that creating myths and depicting myths is important, but he was also about giving you myths and then undercutting it. That's why The Searchers, to my mind, is a great film. So it's like, he gave the myth, but then he ended up inserting a bit of the truth back into the myth, which is just really cool to think about.
Well, I think, I mean, as soon as I didn't have time to rewatch it, but as soon as I watched it earlier this week, I was like, oh man, I just want to watch it again. Like, and I always feel like that, mm-hmm. like, I feel that way with that movie because, like, there are little parts in it that, like, when you watch it again, like, it takes on different meanings because, like, there are some, you know, twists and turns in this movie. Like, there are things that people say, there are, you know, there are shots that kind of get mirrored that, you know, mm-hmm. make it a very, there's a reason why Steven Spielberg watches this movie a lot.
Yeah. You
know? Like, and it's because there's a lot to find in it.
Like, from a symbolic perspective, Ethan is, and this is played out in so many cool ways. So Ethan is the person that found Martin. So he is like his father. He is denying him his, like, you know, that familial feel through the whole movie until almost the end when he's like, I'm going to die. So I bequeath you everything. And Martin's and Martin's like, I don't want your stuff. I just want you to, like, not kill Debbie.
Yeah, just please don't kill Debbie.
I don't want anything because Debbie's actually, like, your flesh and blood. I would like her to live. So, but that's really interesting because that's part of the story is to say, you know, you have to understand where you come from and you have to understand all of the darkness and all of the things underneath who you are. And through the course of the story, Martin understands darkness and he understands what is right and he understands compassion and he chooses compassion again and again and again and again, mm-hmm. except with Scar, who he is in his mind, I think, defending Debbie. So,
yeah, no, I think that, like, they don't show Scar with a weapon, but since, you know, Debbie screams and she clearly sees Scar, like, I imagine he did have a weapon. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in his mind, it was more
defense of Debbie.
But, like, I don't think he did attempt or would have attempted to kill anybody else. And I think that if Martin would have been in charge of everything, he would have snuck in there, grabbed Debbie, left, and none of what happened afterwards, the violence that happened afterwards, would have even happened.
Yeah.
Like, because he didn't want to kill anyone. And he was mad when he saw that the U.S. Cavalry had killed people, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And with, so, like, he really is kind of, you know, he's an outlier, you know.
Yeah.
In the film.
Yeah, what's cool is, like, we have Ethan, who represents this older generation and this, you know, older way of thinking. And we have Martin, who represents the kids that are growing up and are trying to learn from it. And, you know, the older generation is trying to, you know, do what I say, not what I do. And so in so many ways, Martin learns what not to do through Ethan. It's, I don't know, it's just really cool. And it, in some ways, like, we have a lot of the Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker relationship. Like, it's just,
well, it's interesting because it's kind of like, it's not a master and Padawan relationship in The Searchers. No. Because like Ethan, like, is like not wanting to teach anyone. Certainly Martin doesn't want to learn anything from him, you know, like, and he just like, they're both kind of rejecting each other, but they both decided to go on this kind of, you know, this quest. Mm-hmm.
But there is that father and son, like, symbolic relationship because, you know, Ethan is the one that saved him. Ethan is the one that made sure he had a family and a place to live. And then he went off to war. And then, you know, he's also still this kid that he cares about and is willing to. And in so many ways, Ethan is saved by the fact that Martin has been, you know, convinced he will choose the right path if he is there. And that's very Luke and Darth Vader, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's intentional, but it's just really interesting to see it play out and then be like, oh, hey, these themes, these thematic elements of, you know, this cursed father figure is it plays out on screen.
Yeah.
It's cool.
It's a good one.
It's a good one. Yeah. You know, so I highly recommend you watch it. There is, of course, you know, some warnings associated with it. It is very much of its time. It might be hard for some people to watch. I tweeted about it earlier today when we recorded, and or we were going to record, and I was like talking about The Searchers, and people were like, I remember being mad at this movie. And like, I totally get it. There are things that are kind of, you know, hard, but I think it's also important to understand how much of an influence it has had and how, you know, the cinema and the movies that we love, you know, to this day, and the directors that we're like, oh, these people are masters, draw and parallel and still play in homage to The Searchers.
Yeah, and I would say that if you are turned off by violence, it doesn't show a lot of violence, but it definitely does hint at a lot of it. And so, like, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, like we talked about, like, you know, getting eyes shot out of a corpse, you know, like, there, you know, you see scalps, you see the, you know, like, you don't see someone getting scalped, but you see, like, you know, people.
Oh, Ethan is about to at one moment, then it cuts away.
He does cut away, but then you see him holding it afterwards. Yeah. And so you definitely know that he did do that. But it doesn't show stuff, but it definitely does kind of, you get the sense of the horror of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just, you know, hey, if you want to understand how to present revenge and obsession on screen, John Wayne in The Searchers is amazing. If you want to see how to have a POV that shows compassion, even kind of ahead of it, of his time, Martin and his role, it just, you know, that role shows compassion and love incredibly well.
Yeah. And also just like using your location.
Yeah.
In like the best way possible, where, like, you know,
how to establish a location.
How to establish
shots.
A location as character. Like, I mean, because it is, you know, there's a lot of movies that have been made around there, but like that, this one is the best. It's the prettiest. Like, it is, mm-hmm. it really is just stunningly, stunningly gorgeous.
Yeah, I agree. Any other thoughts on The Searchers?
I don't think so. Now I just need to look up Young Jin's hair.
And be like,
I know they did. Like, did they have the same hairstyle? I mean, who cares?
She had
really?
Two pigtails.
But, like,
yeah, she had two.
No, I feel
pigtails.
Like they. I know. I'm gonna look. It's gonna now bother me. They both have little dolls too.
Yeah, they both have little dolls. Yeah.
So that's like my random, like, doesn't mean anything. No one was influenced by it thing. But like, it's something I noticed.
So. Well, like, to say, like, I don't think TFA, like, the parallels are purposeful at all. I just think that there's a lot of, like, because they had a female protagonist who gets captured, it ends up playing out, you know, in parallel because of, you know, who's going after her and she's captured. Like, it ends up having that captivity narrative. oddly enough, I think it's just really interesting because it's a very male gaze view of those situations. And it's like in The Searchers specifically, like very like,
yeah, I mean, like
women don't have power. Yeah.
No. And like they don't have fully drawn characters.
Yeah.
At all. Like, I mean, yeah. that's not what this movie is. Like, yeah. If that, you know. So if like if you need that to enjoy a movie, like, which, you know, this yeah. is not it.
Yeah. Read the summary of it, maybe. But, you know, other than that, it has a lot going for it. And it is still really, I would say, valuable to understand, especially how much it has influenced Western media in general. Yeah. And specifically Star Wars through George Lucas. Well, Amy, this was fun.
Yes.
Yeah. So where can people find you if they are looking for you out there on the internet?
So my website is 365starwars.com, and you can find me on Twitter at 365_Star Wars. If you want just the content that I write, or if you want some more of my added opinions, I am much more active on my personal account, which is just AmyRichau, my name, Amy Rickau. So that is where I am.
Well, thank you for coming on and talking about The Searchers with me. I don't know what we should do next. There's so much. I feel like maybe we should take on like one of the World War II movies that influenced kind of like the bombing sequence or the bombing runs. Because I think
that would be good.
There's also Metropolis, which is like one of my favorite movies. So that would be like a guilty pleasure episode for me. You know, we could also do something along the lines of Rashomon to talk about kind of Ryan and how he specifically brought that into.
Right. Yeah, there's all kinds of good options.
The Last Jedi. But we're going to continue on our cinematic, try to maybe get a couple more in this year rather than once a year. Just so busy. But no, I think that would be really great to do. We specifically wanted to see if there was any influences in the Mandalorian, and so we didn't end up going about that one right away. But yeah, this was always going to be our next one because it was really interesting to take a look at from a Western perspective. So, yep. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is orchestral music composed by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We'd like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force. Melody, Night Huntress, In Wild Space, Susan, Jessica, Brad, Anna Perez, Macau Mom, Neil, and James. Make sure you like and subscribe on your podcast app of choice or on YouTube. Leaving a 5-star review on iTunes helps other people find the show. You can connect with us on Twitter at What the Force Show, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, or on our website, whattheforce.ca. We also have a new Discord. Links are available in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.